The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Margie Wax Weingarten, and my sisters Buffy, Esther, and I endowed this lecture series in honor of our awesome father, Ellis Wax, and his love of history. Thank you. Please consider joining us and make a gift to help the Free Library advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity. It's now my pleasure to introduce our guests. A national political reporter at the Washington Post, Bucks County's own Robert Costa, has earned wide readership and praise from fellow journalists for his deeply sourced and well-founded reporting. He previously wrote for National Review, served as the moderator and managing editor for PBS's Washington Week, and as a political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Co-authored with investigative journalist and best-selling writer Bob Woodward, Peril utilizes hundreds of interviews and thousands of documents to delve into the stunning transfer of power from the Trump to the Biden administration and the resulting crisis for U.S. democracy. Tonight, Robert will be in conversation with New York Times bestselling author Michael Smirkanish, the host of the Michael Smirkanish program on SiriusXM POTUS Channel 124, and the host of CNN's Smirkanish This Saturday. Please welcome Robert Costa and Michael Smirkanish.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Bob, good to be with you.
Great to be with you.
So I regard this as a homecoming of sorts, so permit me three Philly questions at the outset, okay? In the acknowledgments, those three Pensbury teachers, tell me about them.
One of them's here, Steve Medoff. Where is Steve Medoff? There he is. He was my high school debate coach and English teacher. I'm a Pensbury High School graduate. Class of 2004. One of the greatest experiences of my life, and three people, I mean, all of the Pensbury teachers were generous and wonderful, but three teachers in particular, Mr. Medoff, Mr. Wilson, and Mr. Ciola, just embraced me when I was a student. I don't think I did much studying my junior and senior year, just hung out in the forensics, the debate club, the TV studio, and the school newspaper, and they were just great teachers, and teachers are so important, and I had A-plus public school experience in the Philadelphia area. So thank you.
And you told me you're returning to Pensbury at 7:25 Monday morning.
I'm going to do a senior-only's assembly, so none of you can come unless you're a senior at Pensbury on Monday. They asked me to show up at 7:25 in the morning so I can speak to the A-period class, and then I'll speak to the B-period class. I really wonder, looking back, how did we all wake up for high school early?
I'm still doing it, and I will be doing it tomorrow.
So. I know. Can we have a round of applause for Michael Smirkanish, who has a show on CNN tomorrow and is doing this tonight? This is a school night.
It is a school night. So I'm sure this book, which you did not write, looks familiar.
We're talking about another book, Michael.
This is Michael Bamberger's sensational book, Wonderland, A Year in the Life of American High School. And yeah, it deserves a round of applause. And this is when I became acquainted with Bob Costa.
Let me interrupt you, though.
Yeah.
I used to call into his show on 1210 WIP before Wonderland came out. I'm talking 2002, 2003, and I was having dinner tonight with my younger brother Tim and my family, and my younger brother Tim reminded me, he said, you were so annoying calling into that show. Which I had forgotten I was annoying. But
I hope I never hung up on you.
No, you had me on, which was, I think, odd, looking back, to talk politics, because we didn't know each other. But I guess you were looking for callers, so I was there.
His father, a lawyer, had a business card, and the junior class president saw how useful it was, so he ordered some for himself. His card read, Bob Costa, Pensbury High School. Costa worked to get the school wired from the start of his junior year. The first item on his agenda was securing a parking space, even though he didn't own a car and didn't even have a driver's license.
It's true. This is true.
I can see you're blushing, by the way.
Fact check, true.
So when I read Bamberger's book, I was convinced Bob Costa was going to run for office and be covered by journalists, not the reverse. Did you think so at the time? And when did the change come that you decided you'd be on the other side of that wall?
I always thought when I was in high school, maybe I wanted to be a congressman one day because it seemed like I always wanted to participate in history.
Right.
But then when I was in college, I had an opportunity, and in high school too, to cover concerts in high school. I used to come down to the Trocadero on South Street, the TLA. I would cover all these concerts for the Bucks County Courier Times for the reality section. Thank you. I even created my own nickname for the Courier Times called Jam Band Bob, which my siblings still mock me about. And in college, I interned for Charlie Rose, which I guess is not something we're supposed to talk about anymore. But I did intern there. It was a great experience.
Great interviewer.
I interned at ABC News. And anyway, I came to a conclusion that journalism was more fun. And it'd be a great thing to do as internship. I actually didn't really think it could be a career, though. Because it seemed like to get into journalism, you had to know a lot of people. And my father is a great pharmaceutical lawyer, but that doesn't exactly give you an entry into journalism. And it seemed like a world of nepotism to me. And I really had very low expectations about ever having a career in journalism, which in some ways I think is why I've done okay. It's because I never have expectations that this is going to last. So you just make decisions that are a little bit more free form. Without naming names, there are some of my colleagues who are so tightly wound because since age 11, they've wanted to be a reporter. So they're very tight, and I've just never been tight. So people, I feel like I can just kind of waltz through stories because I just, like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, I'll just get to know those guys because, you know, who cares? If it doesn't work out as a story, I can always go back to Bucks County.
Have you closed that door?
Oh, for running, for sure.
You have.
Oh, if you're thinking about running for office, we should talk after this discussion tonight. Because I can tell you how it really is to be a politician. I live in the Capitol when I'm reporter full-time. I live at the White House on the campaign trail. It is a relentless life. It is a terrible scrutiny for your family, for your personal life. And I really believe the press, and this sounds a little bit, I think the press can really make a contribution to democracy. And by shining a light on people in power, I can do a lot of good for the country. I don't wake up and say I'm a patriot by doing this job, but I do feel it does serve an important purpose. And so I've personally come to the conclusion I don't need to run for office. I have no desire to run for office. I just want to be a journalist. And there's a peace that comes over you when you accept I want to be an observer, because once you accept that, you can find a lot of joy in the journalism because you're not trying to ever be in the arena. And I'm sure I'm not to speak for you, but you find joy in having the conversation, not having to be the one answering the question.
Well, I got there a different way because you were at the Pensbury High School. I'm older than you. I was at Central Bucks West.
That's right.
And I had the same aspiration when I was in high school, which is I wanted Peter Kostmeyer's seat in Congress. I got it out of my system when I was
Wins in 1976 after working for Milton Schaap, loses in 80, comes back in 82.
It's a hell of a story.
If anyone understands what I'm talking about, it's Michael Smirkanish.
I spoke to him recently.
He lives in New York, right?
He lives in New York, yeah. But I got it out of my system when I was in law school because I ran for a state legislative seat in our home area.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I lost
you
by...
You ran for the state house?
I lost by 419...
Which year did you run?
419 votes, and I've located 236 of those people. By the way, if you think about that line, it makes no sense. All right, Philly subject number 3, and then I'm done with Philly. This is not an interview we could do in any other town,
no.
Right? As you're doing
or with any other person. I mean, there's no one else. He's the king of Philadelphia. He's from Bucks County. I was so I was fishing when I asked him to do this. And when he said yes, I said, okay.
Okay, so here's what I most wanted to know from Peril. Okay? Four seasons total landscape. What is the story?
There's a line in the book where Woodward and I wrote the whole book together, but there is a line in the book where we use the phrase, four seasons total landscaping is in Northeast, and it's a place where you can get fair price cheesesteaks. And Woodward said to me, what does Northeast mean? Northeast Philly. And I was like, that's the way people refer to Northeast Philadelphia. And he's like, what's a fair price cheesesteak? How much does that cost? I said, don't worry about it. Just leave it in. Leave it in. So the Philadelphia parts of the book, not 50-50.
But you say in the book, page 145, yes. Trump thought Rudy would be at a hotel, not next to a crematorium and an adult bookstore.
All right.
I mean, was it a total F-up? How did it happen?
It was. So this is Saturday, November 7th, 2020. Chronology matters when you're writing these things. So Donald Trump... The election's November 3rd, 2020. And on November 4th, he talks to Kellyanne Conway privately, and he goes, how did we lose to Joe Biden? How did we lose? So privately, he's saying he lost. He acknowledged he lost. But by November 5th and 6th, Giuliani's starting to call Trump and saying, you didn't lose. This was stolen. And Trump goes, yes, it was stolen. The whole thing's rigged. And Giuliani says, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to go to Pennsylvania. I'm going to get Corey Lewandowski. I'm going to get Pam Bondi, the former Attorney General of Florida. And we're going to go just kick some ass in Philadelphia. I apologize. We're at the Free Library. Kick a rear end. My father said to me tonight, do not curse at the Free Library. He's a frequent visitor here. A lot of respect from the Costa family to the Free Library. So I apologize for using the A word. But so around November 6th and 7th, Trump saying, you got to go to Philadelphia. And Giuliani, as we later learned and reported deeply, is not always thinking through the logistics and organization. And he has an assistant named Maria Ryan who emails the Trump campaign and says, we need $20,000 a day. This is a high-paced operation we're going to do for Trump. And Trump says to, they go to Trump and they say, Mr. President, Rudy wants $20,000 a day. And Trump goes, yeah, don't pay him. Don't pay him a cent. Rudy bets on the win. Well, he'll get paid if he wins long term. And they go back to Giuliani and they say, we're not going to pay you $20,000 a day. We'll maybe pay for some of your expenses. So Giuliani's people book Four Seasons Total Landscaping, thinking it's Four Seasons Hotel. But by the time, because it's COVID, Corey Lewandowski, Giuliani, they're all driving up from Washington to Philly. By the time they get there, they're saying to themselves, we got to cover our A. Because this is a mistake, but we're going to still go through with it, Four Seasons Total Landscaping. And that same day, so Giuliani's driving up to Philadelphia to Four Seasons, and that same day, Jared Kushner's in Arlington that morning with Hope Hicks and the rest of the campaign team, and they're saying to each other, who's going to tell Trump? Because the same day of Four Seasons is the day the election's decided. Biden's announced as the winner on Saturday, November 7th. Giuliani's in Philadelphia at Four Seasons. The Trump campaign's in Arlington. And Jared Kushner says, I don't want to go talk to him. Maybe someone else can. And they go, no, Jared, no, we think it's best for the family. He goes, no. The family will come in when it's time for last rites. Someone else should go. And so they go that night to Trump after the Four Seasons thing happens, and they go up to the residence, and we put in the book, on the night of November 7th, after Four Seasons, they're serving pigs in a blanket upstairs in the residence. And Trump starts going, what was that today with Rudy? And everyone's like, we got to get going. We don't, because it was kind of campaign organized. And then that's the meeting where Trump first asks his advisors, where are we going to start finding some more votes? I need 10,000 votes in Georgia. I need 12,000 votes in Michigan. And that was the night after he's angry because he's watching, he's upstairs in the residence eating pigs in a blanket with Diet Coke, and he's watching news coverage of Giuliani being ridiculed. And he starts to say, I'm fighting.
March 31, 2016, you interview Donald Trump as he's securing you with Woodward,
yes.
as he's securing the Republican nomination. And April 2nd, the interview runs, big spread in the Washington Post. I don't know if you've gone back to reread it.
It's a long read.
Yeah, but this is the beginning of your working relationship with Bob Woodward. And Bob, I mean, give you your props. You were already accomplished, obviously, but now you're sort of the anointed one by Woodward, right?
I was his partner on this book. Anointed one. We're in Philadelphia. Come on. Let's relax.
But what was it like initially working with Bob Woodward? That's the question.
Oh, so Woodward and I have always gotten along. So mm-hmm. I met him probably 2014, 2015, and we always got along because we have a very similar view of journalism, which is just go deeper, what's the truth, what's really going on here, cut through the BS. And Woodward and I are talking, I guess, in late 15, and Trump's starting to really catch on. And I'm the lead reporter on Trump for the Post. And I'm with Trump all the time. And I say to Woodward, look, you wouldn't believe these crowds. I've been with Trump for the last 6 months on the road. It's insane. These people are going nuts. I was with Trump in Arizona when he first starts talking about the wall. I felt like they were going to break the building. I mean, it was a visceral, emotional reaction. And I said to Woodward, this guy can win the Republican nomination, and he could win the presidency because he's drawing people who are not the traditional Republican voter. And I had been covering the Republican Party for nearly a decade, and the party had the voter that was coming out for Trump was not the voter who came out just for the Tea Party. This was a new voter. And so Woodward says to me, long story short, he goes, if you think that's right, you got to sit down with Trump and get away from this news of the day stuff, and you got to ask him governing questions. Ask him about how he's going to use power. And I remember Woodward telling me this probably around, we had another conversation in February, and he said, we have to sit down. I said, we should do it. He said, oh, no, you can do it. Go do it. You're the Trump reporter. And I said to Woodward, well, let's do it together. And Woodward hadn't written for the Post in years, a reported story. And I said, let's go interview Trump together. And we sent Trump a letter because I said to Woodward, the way to approach Trump is not an email. He doesn't use email. So let's write him a letter requesting an interview from Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. And Trump calls us up right after he gets the letter and says, I'll do the interview. And we go to see him at his unfinished hotel in Washington, and we sit down with him for about 90 minutes. It's a very long interview. And we asked him governing questions. How are you going to use power? And we broke a lot of news in that story. He started telling us he wants everyone in the government, if he wins, to have non-disclosure agreements. He wants no leaks. I mean, this kind of culture he wanted to build if he won. People thought even in March of 2016, we were kind of wild to go sit down with Trump for 90 minutes. But Woodward, he always laughs. He got two book titles out of that one interview because one time Woodward says to Trump in the interview, and this is where I really got to respect Woodward. We all know Woodward from All the President's Men, his 20 books, bestsellers. But I watched Woodward interview Trump, and I'm probably one of the few people who've seen that happen. And Woodward did something I didn't do, which is talk very minimally. And I realized Woodward would sometimes just say, why? How? Old school questions. Instead of asking a paragraph of a question, and he would listen. And Trump was plugged in because Woodward was clearly listening. And so much I realize about interviewing people who are at the highest levels of politics is showing respect with your eyes and your body language. It's not just the question. It's not about even having intense questions. So are you going to show respect? And usually they will reveal themselves. So Woodward, one point in the interview, says to Trump, what is power to you? And Trump goes, well, I don't want to say it. And we're like, say it. He goes, real power is, and he pauses, I don't even want to say it. Real power is fear. This is in March of 2016. And then he also says, rage, I've always brought it out. I always have. And so if you look at the front page of Fear, Woodward's first book on Trump, it begins with, real power is M-dash. I don't even want to say the word M-dash. Real power is fear. Donald Trump to Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. And then the second book begins with, rage, I always bring it out, I always have. Same interview. And that interview stands to this day as something that really shows you who Trump is. Cold, tough, mean, meandering, not entirely steeped in history. We asked him at one point in the interview, you know, what do you think about the presidency? What do you think about Lincoln? And he goes, Lincoln did some good things. What about the Civil War, Mr. Trump? A real shame.
The story that you wrote was prescient. Not only did I circle what you've already made reference to, but I love this. Over the course of the discussion, the candidate made clear that he would govern in the same non-traditional way that he had campaigned, tossing aside decades of American policy and custom in favor of a new Trumpian approach to the world. He told us so, is what I thought as I read that. Bob, this was the kind of a book, yours with Woodward, where people who got advance copies, the same kind of treatment that John Carl is getting right now, where everyone rushes to say, here are the five tidbits, here are the revelations of the book. So you know that which made the most news. I don't even intend to cover in our short time General Milley all that much because that got such attention. This is a sophisticated audience. They already know that. What did you write? This is the question. What did you write in the book that you think everyone really didn't pay enough attention to?
Great question. I'll begin with the news tonight. Our book continues to be in the news tonight. And that sounds like we're tooting our own horn, and I am. But tonight, and this is a serious story, very serious story. Tonight, Steve Bannon was indicted by the Department of Justice. I'm here as a reporter. Thank you.
By the way, can I say, just in recognition of the applause, if Steve Bannon were here tonight, he'd be applauding with you because I'm convinced he's the happiest guy in the world to have been indicted.
You think he wants to be a political martyr?
Absolutely. He loves this. They gave him exactly what he wanted. He's not going to go to jail for not showing up to the January 6th commission. But I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, he was indicted. He is going to surrender on Monday. So we'll see if he's in prison or not.
He'll be sleeping in his own bed Monday night.
But there's a backstory to why tonight's global news political story is Steve Bannon being indicted. It's the first time since 1983 that someone has been indicted for defying a congressional subpoena. Think about that. Since 1983, we haven't had one indictment in this entire country for someone defying a congressional subpoena. It happened tonight. And the reason Steve Bannon was indicted tonight is directly, and this is not me spinning you, it's directly tied to our book. Because our book, if you look at Steve Bannon's subpoena from the House Committee on January 6th, there is three pieces of evidence cited in the footnote of the subpoena and mentioned in the subpoena itself. And they are literally the scenes in our book cited by Page. And here's why Bannon was subpoenaed and ultimately why he doesn't want to talk. We revealed in this book, and it didn't become news at first. It was kind of a throwaway. It only became news, to answer your question, after the January 6th committee combed through our book and said, wait a minute. What are Woodward and Costa actually telling us here? Because people thought that January 6th was maybe kind of a sporadic thing that happened after a Trump rally. But what we revealed and connected is that January 6th, and I'm not here to say it's criminal or not, but as a reporter, I will give you the assessment that there was coordination of an intense pressure campaign that the Department of Justice will ultimately decide was this conspiracy on a criminal level to commit fraud against the United States. And it is a crime to commit fraud against the United States. And the big news tonight that also isn't getting attention with the ban and indictment is that Merrick Garland has opened up a grand jury investigation onto January 6th, which granted the indictment for this Bannon subpoena. So now there's an active grand jury, and every lawyer in this room knows, I'm not a lawyer, but covering grand juries, the minute a grand jury is opened by the Department of Justice, it can become expansive. But anyway, real quick, Bannon on December 30th, 2020, talks to Trump on the phone, and this is not publicly known until we published our book. Trump's down in Florida. Trump likes to be in Florida around the New Year for one reason, the Mar-a-Lago New Year's Eve party on December 31st. Bannon talks to Trump on December 30th, and Trump's depressed. Giuliani has failed him. They've lost in the courts. Nothing's happening in the courts. The Electoral College has already voted. Biden's been declared the winner by not only the Electoral College, but Mitch McConnell has congratulated Biden as the president-elect of the United States. And Trump's in Florida, and he's furious. And Bannon, who knows Trump's psyche more than almost anyone, was with him at the heart of the end of the campaign in the White House for the first 8 months. He says to Trump, "You can still win this. You can still win this." And Trump goes, "What are you talking about?" Bannon says, "January 6th, you need to make it a reckoning. You need to have all of your supporters in Washington. You have to make January 6th a showdown." And Trump goes, "Well, how do I do that?" And Bannon says, "You can throw the election to the House. There's a way to do this. You got to make it so chaotic on January 6th, and I'm not going to curse because it's free library, but Bannon, if you read the book, it says Bannon uses a lot of curse words to say people are going to say, what is going on here? We're going to create enough chaos where the whole country's in paralysis about the certification of Joe Biden. And he says a chilling line to Trump. He says, even if we don't succeed, Mr. President, we're going to kill the Biden presidency in the crib. And what Bannon meant was, based on our reporting, that they wanted to delegitimize and smear Biden. And remember, Bannon and Giuliani were behind the Hunter Biden laptop promotion campaign. They wanted to smear Biden so much to make it so chaotic with the certification and have these amplified claims of voter fraud that even if Biden was inaugurated and certified, that many voters, millions of voters, would say it was a fraud, it was a phony election. And so it was an odd moment. On December 31st, Trump flies back unexpectedly to Washington. And I remember talking to reporters at the time, and everyone didn't know, why is Trump skipping the New Year's Eve party? Well, he wanted to focus on January 6th. And that same period, December 31st, January 1st, John Eastman, Bannon's buddy, says, "I'm going to write a memo, and we're going to have a what many people are now calling a coup attempt." And so John Eastman writes a memo by January 1st. Bannon's talking about this on his podcast. Trump's in the loop. And by January 2nd, the Eastman memo is revealed to the White House. It's circulated, not shown to anyone in the public. And it shows, here's how we're going to throw out electors, but you need to push Pence to the brink. You need to have Pence participate in the smear to make the smear seem legitimate. So you got to make sure Pence is involved. Compromise Pence. And again, long story short, Bannon's involvement leads to the Eastman memo, which leads to January 5th at the Willard Hotel. Rudy Giuliani, Steve Bannon, John Eastman. And what happens on January 5th, late at night after Mike Pence leaves the White House? Trump calls in. Trump calls in to update Bannon and Giuliani on the pressure campaign. And it was Trump's decision to call into the Willard Hotel that prompted the January 6th committee to issue the subpoena. Because what Peril showed is that Trump was now directly involved with the Willard War Room. And we had not previously known that. And now that we know the phone calls, people seem to be nervous. The president keeps, former president keeps suing the National Archives and others to block his phone records from January 5th and January 6th. And if I've learned one thing covering Donald Trump for 10 years, is that he does nothing by email. Everything is the phone. And if people ask me sometimes, if you could ask Donald Trump one question, what would it be? I say, "Mr. Trump, can you please show me your phone records?" Because the phone records will tell the story.
So I'm so glad that you gave that answer. This is exactly what I want to ask about next. What I most learned from the book, I had been under the impression that there were a lot of moving parts lacking coordination. What I learned from the book was the presence of the Eastman memo and how there really was a concerted plan of attack, although I don't want to give Trump too much quote-unquote credit because I don't think that he's all that organized to be able to pull
it off.
Right,
we still need to figure out intent, the level of coordination.
Right, but here's the missing piece. The missing piece is, why didn't more of a message get to the foot soldiers? And here's what I mean by this, Bob. This is not your reporting, but it's your newspaper. The Washington Post, this past Wednesday, quote, "Court records show that the vast majority of the roughly 650 people federally charged in the riot were not part of far-right groups or premeditated conspiracies to attack the Capitol. Rather, many were an array of everyday Americans that included community leaders, small business owners, teachers, yoga instructors. About 573 have no known affiliation with an extremist group." And then there's this. The vast majority of the participants, quote, "didn't have a plan to overthrow the government. quote, they didn't know what they were doing. A lot of them didn't even know where they were going. They had a message, and the message was, the pitchfork people will show up again, and you need to be afraid of us. I picture the guy with the horns who just got sentenced this week, or the guy who put his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk. For all of the efforts and machinations that were taking place, why wasn't some message in the Willard Hotel on the 5th communicated to those who were supposed to be the foot soldiers on the 6th? For example, it seems to me that one obvious attack would have been be squatters. When you get inside, sit down, don't let anybody in so that the vote can't be certified. Do you understand what I'm saying? That the loop is not closed for me, that they had an end game.
I was outside the Willard Hotel on January 5th, and I will remember that for the rest of my life. I walked around in 30-degree weather trying to figure out what was going on. I don't really remember many reporters out there, if any. It was a freezing cold night, and I walked by hundreds of Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, with military fatigues, and they were outside the Willard Hotel. At the time, I didn't know all the people who were there on January 5th. At the same time, you have Bannon and Giuliani and Eastman in a suite on the third floor of the Willard Hotel. Roger Stone, coincidentally, is in the Willard Hotel that night. And your point is a very valid one. We still do not know if there were cross lines between the hundreds of agitators outside, and it was euphoric in the streets. This Washington, it was like apocalyptic in nature. Washington was totally empty due to the pandemic, but around the Willard, it was just like a circus of people in red hats screaming, tomorrow's the day we take it back, running, fighting with cops, fighting with each other. It was a mad scene. But we still don't know, were those hundreds of people, some of them in military gear, coordinating in any way with Trump people who are upstairs in the suites? That's one area DOJ, the Congressional Committee, have to figure out. Were there cross lines? Were there any kind of communications with these outside fringe groups that were physically in the same vicinity? Maybe there were not. I'm not here to guess. But that question hasn't been answered. But that also doesn't take away from the intent to create total constitutional chaos, maybe using alleged voter fraud that's not founded in anything in truth. That separate effort by Bannon, Giuliani, and Trump could still be seen as criminal by the Department of Justice. We'll see. We'll see what they
do.
Well,
I'm not minimizing. Sure. I'm not minimizing anything. That it was appalling. It was abhorrent. But it just seemed to me that I expected one more piece.
Well, Bannon on his podcast talked about having all the people there occupy the Capitol. So much of, to really boil this down, what Bannon and Giuliani spoke about publicly, and Eastman's memo spells out, and it answers your question exactly. They wanted the Capitol to stop the certification, but due to a confrontation. I don't think they thought they were going to physically get in, but some kind of mass protest outside. They wanted a delay in the certification, so there would be a pause. And I believe this has been reported in the Post and elsewhere that some of the people really wanted to get into the Capitol, but they wanted a delay for one reason. If there was a delay in the certification on January 6th, that gives time for Trump allies in the states to call special sessions to say we need to send an alternate slate of electors to the Capitol.
It was all predicated on intimidating Pence.
Correct.
How tempted was, I mean, you have in the book him consulting with Dan Quayle, among other things. How tempted was Vice President Pence to go along with all this?
I met Pence in 2009 when I was starting out covering the House of Representatives, and there is a little area outside of the House chamber called the Speaker's Gallery, and it's where reporters hang out. You're allowed to hang out outside on the back of the House floor behind where the rostrum is. And so I would hang out there, and you would look for some of the star Congress people of the time, the Paul Ryans, the Pelosis. But I would often see this white-haired, rank-and-file backbencher from Indiana named Mike Pence. And he would just be hanging around. And I realized, you just kind of reporter sense, that this guy was looking to be a quote. He wanted to be in the stories. He was ambitious. So I would go up to him sometimes and say, Congressman Pence, what do you think about XYZ? Well, Bob, I'm so glad you asked. And he would give me a really good answer, spoken full paragraphs, eloquent in his Midwestern way. And I would say, Congressman Pence, That was quite an answer. Bob, don't you know what I did before I was in Congress? I said, no, I don't, Congressman Pence. I was a talk show host in Indiana. Do you know what they called me, Bob? No, I don't. They called me Rush Limbaugh on decaf. I said, that fits. That fits. So I've known Pence since 09. When he was vice president, he would travel around the country. He was so boring to most reporters, Michael, that no one would fly and pool report him on Air Force Two. And so I would volunteer to go be his pool reporter on Air Force Two. And the Post said to me, are you crazy? You cover Bernie for years. You cover Trump for years. Now you want to cover Pence? He never makes news. But I said to myself, just go. This guy could be president. Just go cover him. So I would often fly alone on Air Force Two because no one else wanted to cover the vice president. But I'll tell you, it paid off because you understand just sitting there in the back when you're alone on Air Force Two and they're serving you these hoagie sandwiches and you got an angle right to the front of the plane and you watch who he talks to, who he doesn't talk to, how he handles different things, what he's reading, and I would just fill my notebooks with observations. It wasn't doing anything wrong, but just watching. So much of a reporter's job is watching. And when it came time, when he's really the story, you understand the network of relationships. We all have networks of relationships in our lives. Who really knows? And you understand who really can tell you the truth. And sitting down with people for this book was fascinating because if I asked you, Michael, about your mother, she's one of the legends of Bucks County, Flo Smirkanish. Michael probably has a pat answer. If I asked him for 30 minutes about his mother, he would give me a great answer, but it's probably an answer you tell 1,000 people about your mother. Oh, she's great, X, Y, Z. This is what I think about my mother. But if I sat down with you in my house for 3 hours, fed you some cheesesteaks, got you some coffee, some Diet Coke, and asked you for 3 hours about your mother, about 2 hours and 45 minutes in, you'd go, all right, let me really tell you what I think of your mother.
I'm limited to one more question, then I'm going to surrender the floor, okay? Your newspaper has calculated that there were 187 minutes that elapsed before Donald Trump, after everything hit the fan, until such time as Donald Trump finally told his folks to go home. Sum up what happened in those 187 minutes. I have an image of him in the ante room off the Oval Office watching multiple flat screens and just doing nothing about it.
It's true, and that's why Mark Meadows, who was there that day, is under intense scrutiny right now from the House Committee. The House Committee issued a statement tonight saying if Meadows doesn't comply with his subpoena, we're going to put him in prison as well. We're going to ask the DOJ to have a criminal indictment of Meadows because they know Meadows was there, and as we report in our book, Keith Kellogg, who's Pence's actual advisor, but he's close friends with Trump, the retired general, he's there that day. But I will say this. It's become kind of conventional wisdom, 187 minutes, Trump is idle. And when I first started reporting on this book with Woodward, we thought Trump was a passive figure January 6th. And he was on the surface. He idly watched television. We have a scene in our book where Keith Kellogg walks in and says, Pence is okay. You want to do anything else? And Trump just blinks, keeps watching TV. And Trump has confirmed 1,000 times in interviews that he really wasn't doing much. But that, to me, as a reporter, is not the story. It was conventional wisdom, and it really should be cracked open today, again and again. Donald Trump was not idle. He was idle physically on January 6th. But the story, to me, is between December 30th, when he talks to Bannon, and January 5th at midnight, in the morning of January 6th, he was as aggressive and active as any president could be, pushing every lever of power, state officials, calling them, pestering them repeatedly, barking at them, hold a special session or else, send another alternate slate, find me votes, calling members of Congress, block the certification, screaming at the Pence, you're not going to be my friend anymore. The mob outside wants you to do this. I need you to do it, Mike. Do it, Mike. Eastman says you can do it, Mike. Do it, Mike. Calling up the Department of Justice, find me votes, Barr is gone, Rosen, Clark, help me out. This, and I have sat across my couch and chair for hours with people who had direct interactions with the President of the United States, and they hate when I talk about Trump as idle. And these are some of his closest friends, because they say this guy was relentless. He was idle when he watched the storm he started start to unfold. but he had created the storm. And so, yes, he was idle. The National Guard was slow. As Millie confides privately in her book, January 6th was a grave intelligence failure. After 9/11, our country has become excellent, many people would argue, in terms of tracking international terror, foreign terror on U.S. shores, foreign threats, but doesn't track domestic threats in the same way. And they were not ready with the Capitol Police. They were not ready in Washington with the National Guard. And part of it was a confluence of factors. Remember, in May of June 1st, when Trump goes across Lafayette Square, the D.C. mayor and the D.C. cops said, we don't want another criminal scene here, a violent scene of the police clashing with the protesters, the National Guard. So the National Guard in D.C. that day were wearing their soft uniforms. This was more of a traffic cop operation. So as Millie confides privately in the book, it was a failure across the board. The military wasn't ready. The police weren't ready. So it happens, but you can't spend 9 or 10 months reporting on this and say the story is Trump being idle. Was he non-responsive in those few hours? 100% yes. But he is watching something put into motion that he wanted in motion. He was not surprised. And I think the idleness is sometimes seen as Trump being almost idiotic and sitting back and watching TV, but he was passive because he almost could have predicted, it seemed, what would happen. He stoked the chaos.
I still have the question, and I'm going to surrender the floor, but what did he expect to then happen? Okay, the siege is on. Now what? I don't know the answer to that, and that has not been explained to me.
The answer is in the Eastman memo. He wanted a delay, and he was prepared to call people like Governor Kemp of Georgia and say, there's a delay, there's now time for you to send an alternate slate.
Okay, but I need to see the memo from Bannon or the email or the call where Bannon says to a couple of these knuckleheads from one of those groups, don't leave and don't let them vote. That's not in the public record so far. Let me surrender the Bob. I could talk to you all night, as you know.
Yeah, I could go into more details on that. We'll leave it alone.
It wouldn't be fair, but that's the question.
I'll hang around after. We can have a lot of conversations.
Okay, questions from the audience. Yes, sir. Back on the aisle. Wait for the microphone. Here it comes. And by the way, I'm going to try and run this, as I like to say, lightning round rules, like I do on radio, so we get in a number of questions. I'm going to spin it a little differently and say, is any of what we're discussing here going to shake that base?
The base is so enthralled. First of all, I don't see it as a Trump top-to-bottom movement anymore. The Trump movement has become a bottom-up movement in this country, where Trump himself is actually not directing a lot of this activity. But across the country, even in states like Arizona to this day, in Florida and Georgia, there are active movements to change voting laws for 2024, to make it more accessible for Republicans to have a stake in how votes go to Washington for the Electoral College. All this is happening from the ground up, from Trump allies, not from Trump himself directing it from Mar-a-Lago or from Bedminster. And so it's not about, if you're a Democrat, stopping Trump or an independent. It's about how do you change this whole movement, which is out there and very active and doesn't always listen to mainstream sources. And we don't have a consensus on what truth is in this country. So I don't have an easy answer for you in terms of the media. I just think it takes more reporting. I mean, the more people know facts, and some people who I'm friends with who have read this book, very conservative, have come up to me and said, hey, I love Trump, but man, I didn't know about all this. And I said, that's the whole point. You deserve to know what happened. And I think we all deserve to know what happened. We just still don't know everything that happened. And what stops it? I don't care if Trump stopped. I'm not a political actor, but I think people deserve to have the truth. And the problem is with Trump is he keeps making these claims that the election was stolen. It wasn't stolen. And so we have a whole fight in this country over what's reality versus red versus blue. And that's really the threat to democracy.
But in half the media outlets that are political in nature, none of this matters. It's all about critical race theory and a whole host of other cultural issues.
Let me bring up a Woodward story real quick. Woodward told me in 1972, part of the fun of working with Woodward is we'll get tired of talking about Trump and Biden, and we'll talk Nixon. Woodward one time said to me, because we had reported and wrote the scene of Trump listening to the mob on January 5th. He says, I've only heard about a scene like that once more in my life. And I said, tell me, when? He said, in 1974, Nixon's at the end, and he's so tired, he's drinking, he's angry. He starts talking to the pictures of presidents on the wall. And Woodward put that in the final days with Bernstein, of Nixon talking to the pictures. And now in our book, we have Trump not talking to the pictures on the wall, but talking to the mob. Talking to the mob outside. Trump left the door of the Oval Office open on January 5th so he could hear the cries and screams and music. And when his aides came in, it was almost stunning when I heard this from multiple sources. They come into the room, and they're shivering, and they go, "Mr. President, can we please close the door? It's cold. Mr. President, please leave it open." They have courage. They have courage. We're leaving it open. We want to hear them. And they sat for a whole meeting listening to the mob with an open door in 31-degree weather. But to your question, in 1972, Woodward told me the Democrats lose across the board. McGovern's just killed politically by Nixon in 72. And Woodward says to himself, all this Watergate reporting I did, no one gives a hoot. No one's paying attention. No one's watching. Nixon just won in a landslide. Woodward and Bernstein look at each other and say, hey, what is the point of what we're doing? There's no point. And Ben Bradley says to them, it's not about who wins or loses. Keep working. Stop watching television. Get back to what you're doing. And Woodward says, all right, you're right, you're right, you're right. You know, it doesn't matter if McGovern wins or loses. But they were dispirited because it seemed like nothing was breaking through on Watergate. And that was in November of 72, and we know that's not the case. That's not how it ended.
Question from this side of the room. There's in the back, and here's the microphone right next to you.
Bob, you and I talked a few weeks ago during a Notre Dame game about what people weren't asking you in the discussions, and you said no one asks about Bob.
Medoff blows his off-the-record sources.
I didn't hear him. No one asks about
one asks about Biden.
That's true.
And what I got from reading it was, and then you can respond, I'll be real brief, but sometimes his insecurity, his fear that he's going to make a mistake or that he did something wrong, number one. But number two, the whole thing about the soul of the country as part of his campaign was really significant. And I think it shows the opposite side of what Trump was talking about with fear and other things. So
that's a great question from my high school teacher, Steve Medoff. So Biden's worth another hour. I mean, he's our president now, and he deserves so much more discussion. This guy, 78 years old, fails in 88, fails in 2008, 1% in Iowa. How does he become president of the United States? And you talk to people close to Biden, they say Biden had to have almost a shedding of self by early 2019. He was not going to be the ambitious Joe Biden. It was not about ambition. It was going to be about a mission. And he saw what happened in Charlottesville, and that's why we opened the book beyond our prologue. Our first chapter is Biden watching Charlottesville and talking to his close friend Mike Donilon about it and saying, this is not American. And Biden spurred in political winter when everyone's writing him off to get in because he sees the country and democracy at risk. But the other part of the book on Biden, I think it really matters, is, and it doesn't get enough attention, is Biden is encouraged to run more than anyone by black Americans who say, we understand, and Jim Clyburn meets with Biden, and he says, we understand who Trump really is. We've seen this before in this country, and we're not here to dance around, maybe he could be okay on this or that. He's dark for us. He's not good. He's going to rip apart this country. We need you to run. We need you to save this country. And Biden has this winding decision-making process, but it's really Clyburn who gets him in. Clyburn and others who say, and Cedric Richmond, who's now in the White House with him, congressman from Louisiana, that they say to Biden, you go on Twitter, Joe, and you're going to think this whole Democratic Party is about Medicare for all. Don't listen to Twitter. Don't listen to your younger advisors. Listen to us, the black voters, the working class white voters of this country. We're going to give you the nomination if you just get in. And you're going to have to tune out. It's going to be rough. Tune out all of the chattering of the progressives, the Bernie people, the Warren people. Stay steady. And, of course, it's Clyburn himself who gives Biden the South Carolina primary win when he gets before a few days before the primary and says, Joe knows us. We know Joe. And Biden, because he had been with Obama for 8 years, was seen as a true ally of the black community, black Democrats, and working class white Democrats due to his Scranton, Delaware roots. And he was able to use that persona and that message, the soul of America, all of it combined, to win against all the odds when the party seemed to be drifting left, because he cast himself as the one way to stop Trump.
He has Elizabeth Warren to thank for that. She had no shot at the end. Had she gotten out when she had no shot, Bernie would have won the nomination, and this would have had a different ending. That's just my theory.
And Biden's interesting. You know, Biden has made a relationship. We show it in the book when Warren's brother dies, Senator Warren's brother. Who calls her? Biden. And Biden just doesn't have a five-minute conversation, talks with her for 45 minutes. That's Joe Biden, relationship-driven, and he builds this. Bernie Sanders, I covered him for a long time. One thing Bernie Sanders can't stand more than anything, Senator Sanders, is disrespect. He's been in the trenches going back to 81 in Burlington, Vermont, when he won the surprise race for mayor, and he doesn't want anybody to be dismissive of him, because he, in his mind, rightfully so, considers himself a political warrior, and he always felt Biden respected him. And so instead of having total war like we had in 2016 in Philadelphia, Sanders versus Clinton, suddenly Sanders is working with Biden. And as a reporter, I'd say it comes down to one word, respect from Biden.
But you didn't take my bait, because I'm convinced that Warren was leaned on by Obama et al. You got to stay in this thing. Bernie can't win.
She did stay until April, which was interesting. I don't have reporting on
that.
What
had she won?
I mean, Bernie was closer to winning the nomination. I mean, he was that close. He was really close.
Could you describe what the world looks like to someone who listens to Steve Bannon's podcast every day?
Sure.
How would you know?
Indulge me for 2 minutes. So in 2011, Sarah Palin's going to Iowa. Well, hold with me. Bear with me. In 2011, Sarah Palin's going to Iowa because there's a film being made about her called The Undefeated. It's a propaganda film, a right-wing propaganda film. This is 10 years ago. This is June of 2011. And I decide to go out to cover the Sarah Palin propaganda film because she might run for president. And you want to stay close to Palin if she's going to jump in the race for the 2012 nomination. So I go out to meet with the director of this propaganda film. And the director's name is Steve Bannon. And no one knows who Steve Bannon is at the time. He's not even at Breitbart. And I'm supposed to meet Steve Bannon in a little town called Pella. It's like a Dutch town in Iowa. And I'm supposed to meet him at this coffee shop at 3 o'clock. I go into the coffee shop. Nobody's there. There's a homeless guy. There's a barista. No one's there in the coffee shop. And I'm waiting for Bannon to come. It's 3 o'clock. It's 3:10. It's 3:15. And I'm like, look, I know I'm at the time. I'm 25, 26. I'm nobody. But this director's also nobody. And he's showing me up. And so I call, pick up my cell phone, and I say, hey, Steve Bannon, Bob Costa, I'm here at the coffee shop in Pella. You're 25 minutes late. Where are you? And the homeless man stands up and says, I'm Steve Bannon. True story. And it gets a little darker, though. Bannon's wearing like a military jacket, which I thought, you know, our heart breaks for the veterans, but he was wearing a military jacket. He had a beard like Santa Claus, and he sits down across from me, and to answer your question, we start talking about the film, and he says, I'm going to make Sarah Palin, and I don't know him at all in 2011. This is the first time I've ever met him. He's this L.A.-based right-wing filmmaker, and he says, I'm going to make Sarah Palin the next president of the United States. I said, what are you talking about? She's never going to run. This is all, I'm here to cover the movie, it's political, you know. Anyway, he goes, I'm going to make her the next president. I said, this guy's crazy. Who is he? And he says, you don't understand, Costa. He says, the future of this country is populism and nationalism. And I say, this is 2011. And I say, nationalism? What? No one uses that word. That's like right out of Charles Lindbergh, 1936. What are you talking about? He goes, no. Nationalism is the future because the middle class has been destroyed. The elites broke the middle class, and they're going to radicalize the Republican Party. They're going to take over the Republican Party. And I wrote about Bannon in 2011 using those lines. I'd never heard the term nationalism my entire reporting career until that day. And to really think it's been a 10-year journey from Pella, Iowa in June 2011 to November of 2021, over 10 years, it went from a coffee shop in Iowa to a criminal indictment tonight. a 10-year journey of covering Steve Bannon. And it goes back to the same themes. Palin didn't run, but Trump ultimately runs. And Bannon sees an opening in a broken party. And so does Trump. And Bannon doesn't deserve all the credit. One of the people in history who will be remembered more is this guy named Sam Nunberg. He had problems with alcohol, so he drifted out of Trump's orbit. He hasn't been written about a lot. But I remember when I was talking to Trump in 2013, Nunberg is the person who said to Trump, stop just being the birther. Because Trump loved the attention from being a birther. He says to Trump, start talking about trade and immigration. And Trump was not immediately into it. Trump used to be pro-open border. He used to be critical of Pat Buchanan. People forget Donald Trump flirted with a presidential run in 1999 to run against Pat Buchanan. But in 2013, he starts being anti-immigrant because of Sam Nunberg. And by 2014, he's starting to talk to people at Breitbart like Steve Bannon. And by 2016, he's the Republican nominee. Sam Nunberg's gone. Bannon's his chief strategist. And then he wins.
Kind of had two questions. One is, the National Guard didn't come on January 6th. Wasn't it the responsibility of the vice president or the president to...
Well, they did come. They were slow.
That wheel, the next day.
And so Pence calls the National Guard. Milley gets the National Guard there as soon as possible. But it's difficult because they don't have a huge force there to come to the Capitol. It takes hours. And so they have to get a lot of people, different police forces, different National Guard regiments to come to the Capitol. It's extremely slow. I think the epilogue of the book really details how much of a failure it was, the final chapters of the book. I mean, Milley and other military leaders recognize they barely had a military facility ready to house congressional leaders if there was a crisis. I mean, they all go over to a small military base near the Capitol, and it takes hours for the National Guard to come. And we have a scene in the book, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, a Democrat, is almost screaming at Milley on the phone. She had worked with Milley before. She had been in the CIA. And she said, where is the guard? It's 3:47 in the afternoon. And he says, I'm working on it. And it was a logistics question. It was not about, based on our reporting, Trump blocking the guard, but no one was prepared. Preparation, thinking, those
Bob,
things
can
were lacking.
Can I just say cynically, I, of course, read your book cover to cover. I read Carol Lennig and Phil Rucker's book. I've read all the books,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And Milley comes out looking great in all of them. And I have this perception of him being embarrassed about the role that he played at Lafayette Square.
He was.
And making himself readily available and doling out little tidbits to each one of you to make sure there's going to be something new in each one of the books. And here comes the cynicism. For all that I'm
That's
reading...
That's pretty cynical right there. But
okay,
yeah.
but for all that I'm reading about how he was so alarmed, why did he anticipate a quiet day? I think those were your words on January the 6th.
Lack of imagination. They didn't think through that this crowd could become something truly violent. And it was Milley embarrassed by June 1st. No doubt about it. I mean, we detailed how he and Esper walk across the park, Lafayette Square, and confide with each other. This is the worst thing that's ever happened in their careers. They've been used by the commander-in-chief for a political purpose. And so that I am not here at all to argue against the idea that Milley was deeply embarrassed based on our reporting, and a lot of his conduct could maybe be traced back to how he felt about that experience, that he issues all these statements. We put him in the book saying the military will not be compromised by Trump because he felt compromised by what happened in Lafayette Square. And to your point about sourcing, look, we don't discuss who exactly we talk to. We have deep background interviews with many sources. That means we use everything we collect and confirm. We just don't disclose who we learned about. Yep.
I know, but at Lafayette Square,
right,
he's on the phone with his wife,
right,
and you have the substance of the conversation. Either she spoke or he spoke. I mean, it became pretty obvious. Final comment, and it's mine. You ready for this? So April 2, 2016, your first writing venture with Woodward about the aforementioned interview, 90 minutes long, that you had at the unfinished Trump Hotel. I don't know if you remember the final paragraph of the story, but it's a beaut. You quote Trump as saying, "My natural inclination is to win. And after I win, I will be so presidential that you won't even recognize me. You'll be falling asleep. You'll be so bored. If only." Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to say thank you to Michael Smirkanish, Thank you to everyone who came out, especially the simulcast crowd. I really appreciate you. I'm happy to say hello if you're in the simulcast room. I really appreciate you coming out. And thank you very much to the Free Library. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.